Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is a podcast where people tell me 5 things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick 4 things that they cherish and 1 thing that they wish they could forget. Now, my guest doing that in this episode is Tom Shakespeare. Tom has been a stand-up comedian, an actor, a dancer, and an artist, but he's also a social scientist and a bioethicist, and an academic who writes and talks and researches mainly about disability, but also ethical issues around prenatal genetic testing and end-of-life assisted suicide. Tom has a chondroplasia, so he's not as tall as most people. He also uses a wheelchair. His grandfather, Sir Geoffrey Shakespeare, was made a baronet following long service as a Member of Parliament and in various senior government roles. And his father, Sir William Shakespeare, was a doctor. Despite the baronetcy being an inherited title, Tom refuses to use it. Tom has worked as a research fellow at both Newcastle University and Leeds University, and has worked for the World Health Organization in Geneva. He was a co-author and co-editor of the 2011 World Report on Disability, published by the World Health Organization and World Bank. And he served as a member of the Arts Council between 2003 and 2008. Tom has presented programmes on BBC Radio 4, including A Point of View, and is now the Professor of Disability Research in the Medical Faculty at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He's also a Fellow of the British Academy. Tom has written a number of books concerning disability and has now written his first novel, The Ha Ha, a thoroughly engaging and very entertaining story about friendship, sex, hallucinogenic drugs, marriage, and putting the past behind you, which proves that you can write about disability without making a big fuss of disability. So let's discover what Tom cherishes from his life and would want from it in a time capsule. Here is Tom Shakespeare.
I've put on headphones like I was instructed.
That's perfectly done. Well done, Tom.
Great. Good.
How are you, mate?
I'm fine. I have a back problem at the moment. I had surgery in November. But
Oh, Lord.
So I thought probably best to be horizontal, and if that's okay with you.
It's fine.
Otherwise, if we started with me sitting, I might have to say, I need to lie down now. So that's okay.
Brilliant. I wish I were lying down with you.
It's much easier sometimes.
It's an idea for a podcast, maybe. So I think this is going to be fascinating and fantastic to talk to you, although you're driving me mad, Tom. I read everything about you and I think to myself, oh, my God, I really must try and fit more things into my life.
Well, you might do fewer things better, and that is to be praised. I think I get bored and then end up doing different things, some of which come off, some of which do not.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, this latest adventure, that's quite a departure, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very exciting, and it's what I've wanted to do all my life. So The fact that it's now happening, I'm 57, so I'm not dead yet. I think I could fit a few books in. So hopefully it will be successful and people will want more. But it's really up to readers, you know, will they actually go for it?
Yeah, quite. I think you're writing from a position of knowledge, of course. I haven't had a chance to read the entire book, but I've read the synopsis of it, as it were. And just the title, The Ha-Ha, that immediately made me realise. And then it says a group of old friends go back to a stately home and stay there. And I suddenly thought, oh, my word, yeah, of course, a ha-ha. That's a thing that was built to keep cattle out. And in fact, now keeps people in a wheelchair in.
Well, that's right. But also, I think it was they were built by aristocracy to basically say, we own all this. We don't need a fence. We don't need a hedge. See that? The view? That's ours.
Yes.
And the cattle can't come in your lawn. And hopefully they'll stay out.
Or anything else, indeed. Yes.
I like to think of it as a sort of infinity pool in grass. Because you just see grass heading onwards and you can't see any divide. And that, I think, is why it's called a ha-ha, because you might fall into it without noticing.
I think that must be the reason, yeah. But it's a clever device, isn't it, really? From the house, you have this beautiful view and you think, there's my land, and it just goes on and on and on.
But that's right. All of this is my land, even if it really isn't. But we'll pretend it is.
Yeah? Well, often it was, though, wasn't it? Often it was.
Yes,
as far as the eye could see.
What I think is wonderful, I mean, today is the anniversary of the National Trust, but it's wonderful that things like the Landmark Trust, the National Trust, and all of these entities are owning Britain for us. And we're not aristocrats, but we can go see it, and sometimes we go and stay in it. And I think that's fantastic.
Well, you've sort of decided not to be an aristocrat, haven't you?
Really? Yes. I don't think anybody should be an aristocrat.
And I
certainly
agree.
I'm not an aristocrat. My grandfather was a Liberal MP, and he was made Sir Geoffrey. And there's this principle of inheritance, which I think is wrong.
Yes.
I don't think I deserve to be called Sir Tom. And I've never, ever in my life been called Sir Tom. But technically, I am.
Yeah, yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it, that actually how excited the Conservative Party seemed to be able to get people to be about, we're going to cut inheritance law. And you've...
Yeah, very few people pay it. I think, is it less than 10% of people pay it? So it's not really a problem.
I read it was even smaller than that, about 3% of the people.
There you go. And yet, we think it's a great threat. We demand the right to pass on to whatever it is. It might not be very much, but we jolly well don't want the state to have it. And therefore, if you have a lot of money, presumably, mostly, it remains intact. And I think that's it's a cause of inequality, and I'm against inequality,
Well, yes, I mean, that's been your life study, really, isn't it? That the inequality caused through disability and... well, through all sorts of things, really. And
absolutely.
And also fascinated by the idea of the study of the ethnicity of treatment of people and medicine.
Yeah, definitely. And, obviously, I'm a social scientist. I'm trained as a sociologist. So I think a lot of differences in life are social. They're not really about birth. They're about the way that we decide to treat people. And that might be about individuals or it might be about systems and structures. And we're seeing now that the police are institutionally racist or such and such is exclusionary. And I think it's a problem because whoever you are, you deserve the right to flourish. You deserve a chance to flourish. And we're denying that to young people, to black people, to women, to all sorts of folk, which I think is wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And then internationally, it becomes even more of a problem, doesn't it? If you don't just look at our own country and go, well, look at the disadvantage that certain people have in our society. If you compare our society with the world, it's mad.
Absolutely. And a lot of the research we do, I and my colleagues, is in places like Bangladesh or Uganda or Kenya or wherever, where people are dirt poor. And I'm working with you today on a computer. I'm recording our talk on a mobile phone. All that stuff. Most of these things are not available to most people. And of course, the majority of disabled people are in a developing world. 4/5 of people are in the developing world. So they're missing out.
I've become more and more involved in the world of disability in the sense that my I have two grandchildren who are autistic. And yep. I thought, well, obviously that'll be recognised. But it's been a real struggle, an astonishing struggle.
I bet it has.
I mean, by law, education has to be provided to every child. But to persuade a local council or people in control of these things that they have to pay special care for these children is almost impossible. It's become my youngest grandchild has, or my granddaughter has PDA. And that's incredibly difficult to deal with, but we've had no help at all. It's been mad.
What is PDA? I'm sorry, I don't even know.
It's pathological demand avoidance, which is a form of autism, which is very difficult. She appears to be fairly normal, if you could use that term.
Like the majority, yeah.
Like the majority, yes, quite. And yet, she finds anybody or anything putting demands on her, her brain reacts to it as if she's under attack.
How interesting. I didn't know that that was a thing. I will go away and look at it. And I think what you're saying is that, you know, it's all very well like me. I'm sure I'm in a wheelchair. It's fairly obvious. Well, it's totally obvious I'm disabled.
Yes.
But for the people like your granddaughter, it's not obvious. They look as if they're like the majority. And yet there are certain things that they find very difficult.
Yes.
I went out with a woman who's autistic, and I've not run it today because of the noise and the recording, but the light in my bedroom buzzes. And you and I probably wouldn't notice the buzzing, but boy, she did. You know, the low-pitched hum she was acutely aware of, and she just couldn't deal with it. So please don't turn the light on.
No.
The side light is fine, but the above light, no.
And you have to consider, you consider these things all the time when you're having to be with them and deal with them. Your life changes. And yet, of course, that is exactly what is necessary in all these cases.
Yes.
If we'd ignored it and gone, well, why can't you just do what everybody else does?
Oh, yes, well, sir.
You say, well, because I'm in a wheelchair.
And
for her, it's because if you say to me, put your shoes on, I feel my brain reacts as if you're about to stab me.
Well, it's that's very interesting and difficult, isn't it? It's like my friend. I would say to my friend, "What would you like for breakfast?" Would you like? I suddenly would recite everything. I got toast. I got muesli. I got porridge. I've got this, that, and the other. And she'd say, "Stop! Yeah, too much choice. One thing. Just offer me one thing, and I can say yes or no." So we settled on Marmite toast, and that was fine.
Yes.
Do you want Marmite toast? Yes or no?
Yes, it's just a matter of us all learning to accommodate people.
And to realise that people come in different shapes and sizes. So,
of course, yeah.
You know, for me, you need level access. For your granddaughter, you need to phrase things in ways. For my friend, you need not to turn on the buzzing light. You know, people are different, and most people are affected by disability in some way, either them or, as you say, their family.
Yes, through other people, absolutely, and their lives revolve around it when it becomes impossible to do it. Do you know what I mean? And you sort of think, so well, this would be easy to solve.
Yes,
and yet there are barriers all the time.
And there's so much potential. Whether it's you know it in your own life, in your own family, but worldwide there are more than a billion people with different forms of disability, and they have so much potential. And yet the way that we rigorously organize everything, they're excluded, which is a real problem.
Yes, and madness, really. We are throwing away, well, who knows, the cure to cancer, all cancers, any of these things. It's one, somebody will have an idea that will change the way we think about these things, and it will make it not a problem. And there are all those things in the world. And it may well be that person who is sitting on the floor and unable to move in a mud hut.
I remember as a child seeing that documentary series about art, The Shock of the New, fantastic, presented by, I think, Robert Hughes. And at one stage, he walks among the graveyards of Flanders and he sees all of the crosses. And he says, here are all the people that could have done this, could have done that, could have done the other. Exactly as you say.
Yes.
And disabled people aren't slaughtered, mostly, but they are undiscovered talent. They could do so much more than we allow people to do.
Yes, quite. And yet we still hang on to this idea, or society seems to hang on to this idea, that actually as long as we educate a tiny percentage of people, usually people who come from money, if we educate them highly, they will provide all we need.
And everybody else, you know, they either work or we throw them on the slag heap. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Whereas it's very interesting, if we look at Finland, and Finland always comes near the top of the PISA table of academic achievement in school. In Finland, you get paid more if you educate disabled children because it's more difficult. And, and they prioritize special education and they do it very well. Why do we give more money to people who would probably flourish anyhow? Probably be brilliant anyhow. It's wonderful that they're there. But what is really difficult is bringing everybody else up to that level.
Exactly. And that's where the resources ought to be aimed. Quite.
Exactly. But I think that, you know, the parent of the gifted child or the middle class parent or whomever else says more money and they are listened to. Whereas you know the parents of the child with special education needs are begging for consideration, but it's not being heard, unfortunately.
No.
Not enough.
No, and yet it's by law they have to.
Yes, they do. Two of my friends are solicitors and they spend all their time taking their local authority to court. And a few years ago, I turned up at the Royal Courts of Justice to add support to people who are fighting for special education needs to be better provided for. And why are we fighting these battles? Why are we having told the government to account just to get what every child should have?
Yes, yes. Well said. Well said, Tom. There we are. I think we've done enough. I think we've covered it.
We know what we're going to do. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we should get out in the world and make a difference. It's quite, but before we do that, Tom, we're going to talk about the five things you've chosen to put in a time capsule.
Sure, sure.
Lovely.
Right. Well, the first thing, I don't know if this is how time capsules work, but I wanted to put in the work of J.S. Bach. So there's something like 1150 or whatever pieces of music. so it'll have to be a pretty big time capsule, or maybe it's all recorded. To be honest, I want to put all of Radio 3, but I figured that probably wouldn't be allowed. And then I thought, well, what will I do? Will I pick one piece of music? And I thought, well, if you pick Bach, you did get lots of different things.
Yes.
You got things like the Gobo Variations and the cello suites, and you got all the cantatas, and you got the mass, and you know, and you got loads of concertos and so forth. You don't get operas, but you get everything else. So I thought, well, I think that is a, you know, it shows what human beings can do. You know, he lived, I think, 65 years, but gosh, did he fill it.
Isn't he the composer that has more than one piece of music on that disc that they sent into space for somebody to discover one day?
I think he does. Yes. Voyager spacecraft, yeah.
That's right.
So somewhere in the outer reaches of the galaxy, which is great. And, you know, I think I love Schubert and Beethoven and Mozart and Handel and all the rest of it. But Bach gives you all of that. And I think that's why I would like to preserve him.
And I think they all credit him, don't they? At some point, they credit him as saying, we only do this because of what he did.
Yeah, I think so. And we're still listening to him. We still think he's important. And he died in whatever it was, 250 years ago.
Yeah.
So we still think he is the father of us all. I mean, he had many children, as you know, but he is, in a way, the father of us all, certainly in the West, and probably more globally is appreciated.
Well, I think so, yes. The fact that still, quite often, people will say, can you hold a moment, and then you hear a piece of Bach played over your phone.
Yes, some teeny awful piece of Bach, air of a G-string, or where sheep may safely graze, or whatever. Because I think he's very good at tunes. Yeah. And just to think about 1150 or whatever it is, pieces of music, I was thinking about this just now. I find it very difficult, you know, like coming up with plots for a book. It's not easy. It's hard. And yet he came up with 1150 or whatever it is, pieces of music. And they're not the same. Handel recycles all the time. And of course, Bach would do a bit of that, but mostly they're original and they are fantastic. And the reason that you have them on your ringtone or your hold music is because they're instantly recognisable and they will get into your brain. They're little bugs which you'll carry with you.
It's almost as if music was just flowing out of him without him having to think about it.
I mean, exactly. And it's so difficult to be creative. It's so difficult to paint, to write, I think. But how on earth do you, you know, like the chorale, the hymns in the chorales or whatever, how do you come up with, and not just the words, but the music, which makes them all different and all distinctive?
It's an extraordinary thing. I think when you see someone who's that creative, and as you say, 250 years, it's amazing, isn't it, that actually in almost everything else culturally disappears in that period of time.
Yeah.
Now, all the writing of that time, to a large extent, is not read anymore.
No, apart from Shakespeare, Bach, you're right, we've pretty much forgotten it. I mean, he was born, I think, in about 1685. So you're right, we don't read books from that period, but every single day you hear that music.
Yeah, that's incredible. That is absolutely incredible, Tom. Let's put the complete works of J.S. Bach
on a disc. You've already identified the disc. It'll be fine.
Okay.
It'll be great.
I'll put in some means of playing it, obviously, because...
I hope so,
yes.
Because otherwise it'd be very depressing.
In fact, with that amount of music, we should just have it on a loop.
Yeah, that's all. I think it would take you literally days and days and days to hear it all, but worth it.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, that's number one, Tom. So what's your second choice?
So my second choice, like you, I only have one granddaughter called Ruby, who's a joy, really. And I would like to take her. She's very keen on beads. And I'd like to take her bead necklace. They're big white beads. They're not distinctive. They're made out of plastic. But I think in taking the beads, I think it is a way of marking not just Ruby, who's fantastic, but all children. And when I see Ruby playing, I remember her mum. Her mum is now 35, but at her age, you know, she played, and between birth and say 12, where they enter the tunnel of adolescence, which is more difficult for them and for us. Children are delightful, as you know, and we forget that. It was only when I saw Ruby playing that I remembered her mum. And her mum at that age. And I think of her mum at this age, and she's wonderful. But that age was absolutely perfect, as your children, grandchildren and children were to you. And I think we live in a very adult world. And I think to remember that we were all children, whether we have children or not, we all have a relationship with children. And, you know, absolutely fabulous. And I think we don't value that enough. We don't value children's literature, we don't value children's art, music, television, anything, but we should. And those beads are my way of saying this is very important. It may only be a plastic set of beads, but it stands for a lot more.
Yes, it's a wonderful thing, isn't it, to watch, well, the intensity with which children play. It's astonishing to see the concentration involved in it. I was just thinking at Christmas, my four grandchildren turned up and I had these snowballs that were made of sort of cotton wool, and they decided to have a snowball fight, but they organised it in such a way that it was an extraordinary game. They made it fair.
Fantastic.
They each found a little bell that I have. I have this set of bells that play different notes, and they all took one each so everybody would recognize whose bell it was. And before an attack with the snowballs, they would ring the bell to warn the others.
Fabulous. That is very elaborate. I went to Venice Biennale a few years ago, and the Belgian offering was this artist called Francis Alice. And what he's done, all it was films of children playing. They were children from all over the world. And I remember particularly, you've probably seen it, this child from an African country at a mine, and they had an inner tube of a truck, and they were wheeling this inner tube up the slope. And you thought, what on earth are they doing? Why is this a game? Why do they have to do this? And they got all the way to the top of the slope, they got in the inner tube, and they wheeled down the slope. And of course, the rubber protected them, and they were good at balance. And they went bouncy, bouncy, boing, 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 boing. And that was their toy, but they made it their own. And there are many sorts of games, as you know, and some of them we just don't understand. And in some cultures, they're games played only by girls. And you watch this, because Francis Alice has collected all the videos of them, and you haven't a clue as to what they're doing. but it makes sense to them. Yeah, it's a whole world that we don't really understand.
No, childhood, yes, indeed, is a world that we don't really understand.
Yeah.
because we forget it, don't we? We move away
from it. I think that's correct, Michael. We completely forget it. And that's why the beads for me are important, because I'd completely forgotten Ivy as a child. And then seeing Ruby, I remembered Ivy. And in fact, you know, we meet lots of children and they're all equally exciting and valuable and fascinating.
Yes, quite. I think the world is sort of the wrong way round sometimes. For example, when people are having a conversation around a table, and say you're having it at a dinner party or a lunch, and a child pipes up or comes up and says, "Mum," and they go, "Just a minute, darling, just let me finish." Now, I understand the politeness of that, and I understand the social training that's going into that. But I think that when a child has a question, for them, it's immediate. It's that moment. They live in the moment, children. And we are quite capable, as we demonstrate when a waiter interrupts an anecdote, as they always do, that we're able to defer things. We've learnt that skill as adults. And children, for them, it's now. I need this answer now. And I think that we should be giving them that right.
Yes. Yeah, I think we, generally speaking, I think what you're saying is we should listen to children. And that is important in all aspects. At the moment, I'm reading the shorter fiction, Terry Pratchett. I got given it for Christmas. And one of the things that he said stuck in my mind particularly, and that is that he wrote for children as well as for adults. He said it's much more difficult to write for children.
Yes.
They really get what you're trying to do and ask you the exact pertinent question. and yeah, it was great. I've never written for children, but it makes me think, gosh, that would be a really exciting challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have to be succinct. You have to be to the point. You can't waffle on. I knew Terry a bit. And I know. I was very lucky. I read some of his books for audiobooks, and we met on a number of occasions. And what a fantastic man he was.
Reading this book, just this short fiction is so wonderful, so fantastic. Can you give me an anecdote? When did you really realise how fantastic he was?
Well, I'd been a fan for a long time. I mean, I read all the Discworld books and thought they were beautiful and very funny, great jokes in them, and yet really compelling stories. That's what he's capable of doing. So I'd been a fan, and then I got a phone call from my agent saying, the BBC Radio 4 have asked, would you do With Great Pleasure, which is where a bunch of actors read somebody's choices of literature. And I said, great. And I'd already done it for quite notable people. And she said, it's a writer called Terry Pratchett. And I went, oh, my God.
Wow.
I was so excited.
I bet. Reading a short fiction, he writes about signing books and the rules for a writer. It was very interesting because I'm interested in Terry Pratchett, and that's why I've got this book, being given this book. But as somebody who's just written a book, he tells you about writing, he tells you about signing, he tells you about book tours. I mean, I don't ever anticipate being that famous, but it's great to hear how he experienced it. And what comes across is the generosity. I'm about to read the work that he wrote for children. And I'm really excited about that because I wrote off Terry Pratchett, and then my son said, you know, it's really good, you know. And I thought it's this pointy hat book, Sword and Sorcery. I'm not really interested in that anymore. But I started and I was hooked. And I thought, well, I've got to read them all. There's something like 30 and 40 of them. So I've started at the beginning and I've got about five left. And I'm really eking out because I don't want to finish them all too quickly.
Yes, it was such quality what he wrote, and it was never really rewarded properly. For example, I think that Mort, one of the early Discworld books, is one of the greatest books ever written. It's so perfect.
He was so ingenious, and the way that he has of writing death in small capitals and no inverted commas, because the voice of death is just in your skull. it's fantastic, and I loved it.
Lovely.
And if I may, the next thing I want to keep is that sort of humour. And I think that Terry Pratchett is obviously a great example of it. The original was P.G. Wodehouse. Well, probably the original was Jerome K. Jerome, but then P.G. Wodehouse and Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams and Stephen Fry and a lot of people who are masters or mistresses of that way of just writing jokes. I'll tell you a story, and it's partly why I think that writing humour is important. You might have seen the film Sullivan's Travels by Preston Sturges. And this guy sets out to write, to direct a film, which will be really, really social commentary, social realist film. And the film is called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes.
So obviously Coen Brothers reference that. Anyway, he explores homelessness and all the terrible things of the world. And by a strange set of circumstances, ends up himself a prisoner on a chain gang. And at the end of the film, he comes in, the prisoners shuffle, and they go into an African-American church to watch a film. And there's a sort of rough screen, and they're all sitting there, and there's going to be this film. And he thinks, gosh, you know, we are really exploited. We're really excluded. What will be this great social realist film? And the film, when they're predicting it, is Mickey Mouse. And you can see his face. You go, what on earth is this? Why are you showing us this? And then he realizes that all of the convicts and all of the African-American folk, everybody's laughing. And this point about humor, that it can release, it's a very pleasurable thing to laugh.
Yes.
And all of these people that we mentioned are extremely good at just making you guffaw. And I would like that.
Yes, they really are. I mean, P.G. Woodhouse is, I think, amazing because he doesn't seem to try to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's just people talking. You could easily read those books and just think, well, that person's just a bit stupid or that person's a bit pompous. But it's knowing those types that makes you recognise the humour in it.
And we're not in the 1920s. We don't have Chinless Wonders or whatever in our daily lives. Yet we can identify earls and gardeners and valets and we think they're funny. And yet it's like a bit like Bach. 100 years later, it's still funny. And I think 500 years later, because fundamentally human beings, I presume, are not going to change very much. And so it might be not our world, but it is the world we will enjoy. And the same is with Douglas Adams. I mean, whoever, has stolen Infinite Improbability Drive, nobody. Or Terry Pratchett, these are fictions. And we know they're fictions. They're clearly ludicrous, but they're so funny.
Yes, and they're only as absurd, for example, a lot of things that Terry writes, or in fact that Douglas wrote, they're only as ridiculous as the things that actually really do exist.
And a lot of what both of those authors wrote is satirical. I mean, it's not really about, the Infinite Improbability Drive. It's about suburbia or Croydon or whatever. And same with Terry Pratchett. It's not really about this world. It's about our world.
Absolutely. I once did a play based on the golfing books by P.G. Woodhouse.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, all the lines in it were taken from his books. But there was one joke that I put in. And to my enormous joy, when it was reviewed, they said the play is very funny and full of wonderful P.G. Woodhouse jokes, like, and then they quoted my joke.
Oh, fantastic.
I know.
What
can you imagine?
An honour.
Yeah.
And when you come up with a perfect line, very well balanced and very funny, what a joy. And really making people laugh. And what could be better? I mean, P.G. Woodhouse was certainly quite shy and retiring, I think. He lived with his wife from Long Island. He, as you say, he had almost effortlessly ability to write, but he didn't really do much else. He wrote plays, he wrote musicals, and he wrote novels. Short stories, and that was what made him happy, and indeed made us happy.
Well, humour of all sorts.
Humour will be in there somewhere, somehow.
Absolutely. I love a well-phrased joke. It's my life's ambition to write the perfect joke. There are people who've, I think, have done it. There's the Bob Monkhouse joke, which is, when I die, I want to die peacefully in my sleep, like my father, not screaming in terror like his passengers.
Immediately. I mean, it's so well... time you've done that very beautifully, but it's fantastic, and it's you cannot not laugh. I mean, I defy you to not laugh at that joke or Barry Cryer's joke. So he was wonderful for one-liners. You couldn't stop him joking. I mean, a friend of mine who's a comedy actress said that comedy was like a muscle, and if you developed it, you got better at it. And I've always hoped that that's true, and I've always tried to do that. But some people, they're just effortlessly. I mean, like Barry Cryer, like P.G. Woodhouse, like Terry Pratchett, it just blows, as you say, they secrete comedy. There's very few people like that, but well, how wonderful they are.
It's very interesting how it sort of flows into the idea of, as you were saying before, about how important children are, because to make children laugh is very difficult. As you say, to write a book for them is very difficult, but actually to entertain them is much harder than people imagine. People think you just put a silly costume on and jump about and make noises. But actually, it's incredibly complicated writing something that will keep children engaged. And if you go to see a pantomime and the children remain engaged right the way through it, then that's a really good pantomime.
Yes, yes, that's very interesting. I mean, I think I can entertain one child for a certain amount of time, but writing something that entertains a whole theatre full of children, all the readers, you know, for the length of the book or the play or the pantomime, that's extraordinary. It must be extremely difficult.
Well, I look forward to your efforts, Tom.
I will try. I promise you I will try, yes.
I was going to ask you, is achondroplasia...
Achondroplasia.
Is that inherited?
Yes, it is. Right. And so my father, who is a GP, he had it.
Right.
He passed it on to me. My brother is average height, so he's quite tall. Mm-hmm. And I passed it on to my children, so Ivy and Robert and Ivy's daughter, Ruby, have all achondroplasia. But Ivy's mum didn't have achondroplasia. So it flows onwards and it's a 50%. And in fact, anyone can have a child with restricted growth if they're really lucky, because it does happen sort of, as it were, randomly, because our DNA, our copying is not very good, really. It's a bit like, I think of it as a bit like a photocopier. So women obviously have eggs, which last forever but deteriorate with age, and men have sperm and they keep on making sperm, but just like with a photocopier, errors occur, you know, blotches. You know, when you've done 150,000 photocopies, then it starts falling apart. That's why you get lots of single gene mutations, like achondroplasia, just spring up without any warning.
And of course, the world for Ruby will be much, hopefully will be much different to the world that you were born into.
Absolutely. And indeed, my father, who was born, he's dead now, but he was born in 1927. And at that stage, you know, disabled people were mainly shut away or didn't cause a fuss and didn't achieve much. And my dad wanted to be a doctor. His father, who's a parliamentarian and all the rest of it, he wanted him to have a quiet life and my friend will sort you out and you'll be a manager in London Brick. But my dad really wanted to become a doctor. And there weren't any disabled doctors, certainly no doctors with restricted growth. And he went back to college and he went to St. George's and he became a GP and he was a brilliant GP and did that all his career. But his success, if you like, was proving that you could be, as it were, normal if you were different. And my success, if you like, which is very much based on his great lessons to me, my success is saying, well, actually, you could be different and you don't have to be normal. You could be eccentric, and that is also fine.
Yes, nobody's really normal.
No, and my dad wore a three-piece suit and in a way was a doctor like any other and had a bag and liked a glass of whiskey at the end of the evening and all the rest of it. So very, very normal. And he was at the boat club at college and all of these normal for his class and gender things that he did. And I would say, well, you know, I want to subvert that. I want to be a bit different.
Yeah.
And the fact that I can do that is because he did that.
Yes, it's only extraordinary what he did because of the barriers he would have come up against.
There must have been so many barriers and so low expectations, starting with his own father. People cannot have expected him to flourish. And as you know, medical students have to do surgery. How on earth was this little guy, 4'5", going to do surgery? Standing on a box. And so he did surgery.
Yes.
And he did pediatrics. And the children, back to children, used to jump on their beds and say, we want our little doctor. We want our little doctor. And of course, being small of stature, they loved him. And they wanted, and it was very funny because, as you know, this book, The Ha Ha, did come out in March 2024. And a guy on Twitter got in touch with me and said, has anybody got the rights to this book? And I said, I don't really understand, but no. Anyway, so he said, I want to read this book. He has made films and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that he wanted to have a look at whether he could option a book was because my dad was his doctor.
Right.
And so he came into the world, however, 50 years ago or however many years ago, because my dad looked after his mum and enabled him successfully, safely to be born. And I get those reminders all the time. They say, are you Bill Shakespeare's son? Are you Dr. Shakespeare's son? I say, yeah. Oh, he was amazing. He was brilliant. So it's a very lovely reminder, if you like.
Fantastic that your dad was called William Shakespeare.
Well, yes. People didn't used to believe it. he had an accident once. He was catapulted into a ditch and he woke up in a hospital. And they said, what's your name? And he said, William Shakespeare. And they thought he was concussed. They thought he was completely, you know, making no sense whatsoever.
Yes, of course you are, sir. This way, here's the jacket.
Yeah,
yes.
He was lucky he got out. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think he had to get somebody to vouch for him to say, no, this really is William Shakespeare. And when he got married, his best man was called Macbeth. It clearly had a great sense of humour. And of course, it was on all of the pages of the newspapers. So what a cheap way of telling everybody you're getting married. I have a best man called Macbeth.
Brilliant. Right. OK, well, there you are. You see, you've just demonstrated why we should have humour in the time capsule, Tom.
We need it.
Absolutely. Right. Well, let's move on to the next thing. OK, ad break time. Back very soon.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome back. Right, let's find out the final things that Tom Shakespeare would like to have in his time capsule.
Okay, well, I want toast to be in the time capsule because I think toast is very important. And I wasn't sure about this because I had toast and marmalade for breakfast. And I thought, well, maybe marmalade should go in the time capsule because I love marmalade. And some years it's like gravy and some years it's like rubber. And so, every third year I make, for me, perfect marmalade. But, you know, as long as you've got a supply, you're okay. But I also bake my own bread. I bake bread every week. And I may be a little bit boastful, but I love my own bread. And so I thought, well, I could put my own bread and that would be a little bit arrogant. But to be honest, what I really like is toast. And you can put savory on it, you know, cheese, you can put marmalade, you can put marmite, you can put honey, you can put peanut butter. And I don't think any culture in the world has toast like we do. I mean, obviously, you can get toast and you can grill bread, but having the right bread, toast in the right way is a wonderful thing. And it gets you through a lot of scrapes, if you like. I know you can't carry it with you, but it's fresh, it's hot, it's toast. And so let's keep that.
It must be ancient as well when you think about it. I mean, the invention of fire, the first thing you do is put your bread.
Put your bread on a stick and drop it in the fire or something. Yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely. But why is it that toast, I mean, the British have made toast a sort of art form, if you like. And I don't believe it's the same anywhere else. And I think it was Somerset Maugham who said, if you want to eat well in England, eat three breakfasts. And basically, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Just the breakfasts are fantastic. And I think what is at the heart of a good British breakfast is toast.
Mm. Although the world is divided, or, well, this country is divided, by those people who like to put it in a toast rack and let it cool, yes, and those people who want it straight from the toaster. I'm a straight-from-the-toaster person.
So am I. Mm. I like my butter to melt. I
of
don't,
course.
Whereas some people like their toast cold, and then they sort of, they literally plaster butter as yes, if it is plaster on the bread, which I think is a sure way to fur up your arteries. So this is out half the point.
Yes, yeah, so I suppose the idea is that it goes harder, doesn't it, if you let it cool? But no,
it goes harder and you can fit more butter on it. I bought my girlfriend a book for Christmas called Butter. That's all it was called. It was just butter. And every recipe was, I mean, it should have been called Heart Attack City. And
yes,
that would have been the perfect book for her.
Yeah, or Michelin-starred restaurant, because that's basically what
well,
it is.
Well, yeah, they have a lot of butter and a lot of salt as well. Mm-hmm. Goodness knows how they survive. But
yes,
yeah,
but it shows you how delicious those things are.
They are.
They're always gorgeous. Well, I love a piece of toast. I agree. And it would be weird if you made your own bread, Tom, and then said, I don't really like it, you know.
Presumably, there must be people who all they can make is stuff they don't like. And I love cooking, and I've got friends who they say I made X, but it wasn't very good. And you think, well, make it good, you know, change
or
it,
don't
you know,
make it, yeah,
or don't make it. Eat out and go to the Michelin starred restaurants if you can afford it. But that would be a great story, wouldn't it? Somebody who couldn't bear the taste of their own bread. My mother was a very good cook, and my grandmother was a very good cook, and my great-grandmother was a very good cook. So it runs in the family, if you like, that you want food. And my mother and grandmother and great-grandmother were from Sri Lanka. And in Sri Lanka, they don't have toast in a way that we do in terms of Sinhalese or Tamil cookery. But breakfasts are so good. So maybe it's breakfast. Maybe it's not toast. It's breakfast. I think, can I change my bid?
You can. In, it's your time capsule.
And put in breakfast.
Okay.
Because some people don't eat breakfast. How misguided, how foolish. What on earth do they do when their blood sugar crashes because they haven't eaten breakfast or they've only had a cup of black coffee? That is not breakfast.
No. And often when people don't eat breakfast, they tell you they don't eat breakfast in a way that suggests that it's healthy.
Yeah, proud. It's not good.
No. You've been hours and hours without food.
Awful.
And suddenly there's the opportunity.
Isn't it the case that there's a saying which is that you should breakfast like a king, you should lunch like a lord, and you should sup like a pauper? Because I think it is better for the human mechanism to have your food early on and digest it. It's very bad to have a lovely great dinner last thing at night. It's a wonder that the Spanish have created anything because they eat such late and big meals last thing at night. But they need a siesta. We don't have a siesta because we have breakfast.
No. So in many ways, because they have the siesta, their evening meal is like a breakfast.
Ah, that's cunning. Then maybe they really do have more than one breakfast.
Yes, they've worked the world out. Brilliant.
how well to live, yeah. And I think, breakfast, and for me, that's muesli is good, but it's a bit virtuous. You feel glad you've eaten it. You don't necessarily feel good eating it. Whereas who could feel bad eating toast? Point to me the person who says, oh, I don't really like toast. I don't believe that's possible.
I agree. Yes. I mean, we talked early on about, you know, discrimination against people, but that's one area that I'm happy to discriminate against.
Right. Okay. So you can be any colour, any gender, whatever, as long as you like toast.
Yep.
In our new world, brave new world, that will be the rule. Yeah.
Absolutely, Tom. Brilliant. Well, we shall put breakfast in there, and that will, of course, include toast. Nice and warm, plenty of butter to melt onto it. And marmalade, your own marmalade.
Oh, well, only 1 year in three.
Yes, all right. The best ones.
In a good year, my own marmalade, yeah.
Lovely. So we've only got one thing left to put in, Tom.
Well, you've picked up the two things I like, a laughter and all of those other children and books and everything. And I like eating things. I like consuming things. So my sign name, you can't see me perhaps, but I'm pointing my hand at my mouth, and that means eating. Your sign name is meant to be, when you're learning British Sign Language, the thing that most characterizes you.
Right.
It could be laughter, which is holding your mouth and shaking it. Mm. But in my case, it's food. And so I want for my fifth choice to put something that I like to drink, because I've already had breakfast, which is all about what I like to eat. And so I was thinking, well, I love wine, I love whiskey, malt whiskey, I love Islay whiskey, all the rest of it. So shall I? But I couldn't choose. And there's just so many. So what I want to put in is really, and it's a bit like toast, but toast is about texture. I want to put in taste, the taste of a fine wine or a whiskey. And I'm not a super taster. Some people a friend of mine's son is absolutely perfect at tasting all the different things. It's an amazing gift, and if you can afford it, because if you have to eat or drink terrible things and yet you know it's not quite right, it must be terrible. But yeah, every now and then I can afford a bottle of malt whiskey or a bottle of Burgundy, and I love it, and I would like to have that taste, that ability to distinguish. You see, my mouth is watering because I'm thinking of all of these things. And it's not about alcohol. It's not about getting drunk. I think it's good for you once in a while not to have any alcohol. So I'm drinking a lot of Guinness Zero. Now, Guinness Zero is a very good taste because it's like full-strength Guinness.
Yes.
You couldn't really tell.
No, it's fantastic.
It's absolutely brilliant. So I don't really care if it's got alcohol, but I do care if it's got taste. Mm. It's brilliant because it tastes like Guinness. And similarly, the Burgundy or the whiskey or whatever, fantastic.
Well, of course, with those really good wines and those really good whiskies, you don't need much. It's not about the quantity at all, is it? I mean, I once drank a fantastically good bottle of wine with a friend of mine. We opened it, we decanted it, we left it to breathe, and then we sat down to drink it. So you'd think half a bottle each, that would be fine.
Yeah.
It lasted all evening.
Fantastic.
Most of the time you were just smelling it.
Yeah, and I think that is it, isn't it? Because taste is a lot in the smell, but it's mm-hmm. also that you probably held your glass up to the light and shone the light through it. And if you're a real wine connoisseur, you'll look at how it sort of flows, the viscosity, mm-hmm. if you like.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that you might like. And my son, who is a whiskey, I was going to say bore, but I mean buff, he knows all about whiskey. So, you know, he'll tell you, oh, that's brown because the caramel. You don't want to have it brown because the caramel. You want it, you know, and this is seaweedy and that's peaty and that's smoky and all the rest of it. But I do care. But mainly I like that, as you say, that expression, that feeling of tasting these different tastes and trying to, is it more like leather? Is it more like tobacco? Is it mm-hmm. more like petrol? Although it's sad, and we ridicule the words that people use, but we're trying to grasp at something which we cannot achieve, which is to put into words that amazing mouthfeel, that amazing texture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my wife will often smell a wine and go, oh, it's quite a bit of urine in that.
Well, which sounds awful.
Doesn't it?
It sounds really bad. But I remember when my father first gave me a sip of beer, too bitter, hated it. Mm. And similarly with whiskey when I was, you know, a young teenager, hated it. I wanted more sweet drinks. But now, as a middle-aged person, I think, oh, these are fantastic. But it's very cultural. So in the book I'm writing, which is a sequel to the first book, I've got a couple of Lapp people, Sami people. They're Scandinavians. They're Nordic people. Mm. And therefore, they'll like heavy metal and they'll do unspeakable things with food.
Yes. The more it's gone off, the better.
Exactly. Or lutefisk, which is fish with lye, which is horrible, but they love it. And I remember on a Norwegian boat once, ship, there was cheese and there was old cheese. So I love cheese. I thought, well, I'll try that. Disgusting. It's like eating cobwebs.
Mm.
And the flavour in my mouth for the rest of the day was this terrible flavour of basically mouldy old cheese. But other moldy cheese, like Stilton or Roquefort, we love. So it must be cultural. They must love lutefisk and they must love old cheese and all the rest of it, which we can't bear. But it's not genetic. It's acquired.
Yes. The same with things like chili and indeed curry. The idea of the heat of things, some cultures, they don't even notice it. I mean, they will put enormous amounts of incredibly hot chili into food and then just eat it. Anybody who's not used to that, as you say, you've not trained your palate.
That's right. I remember having a pasta arrabbiata, which, as you know, is a sort of spicy pasta. So it's quite hot. And I was eating it with two Indonesian friends. And they were eating the pasta with a fork or whatever. And one of them had they had chilies in front of them, raw green chilies. And one of them, as they forked in the pasta arrabbiata, munched one green chili. Well, that's achievable. The other one, and I counted, ate seven green chilies. And it wasn't a boastful, show-offy thing. It was just, this is like salt. It makes it taste better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you say, we could never do that, I think, or few of us could do that. We wouldn't want to because it wouldn't taste good.
No. But you're right about the taste of those things, though, putting the taste in. That taste varies, of course, according to where you are, who you're with. That's the joy of it, I think, that actually you can drink a really quite cheap wine in the perfect place.
Yes.
Or where it's made quite often, and it's gorgeous.
And it will taste amazing. Yeah, absolutely. I was lucky enough. I've been to Mull, I've been to Isla, I've been to the source, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I remember on Mull, Tobermory, which is these lovely painted cottages all in a row. I went to the Tobermory distillery, and they make the beer, and then they distill it into the whiskey. And they had this huge mash tub of the first stage of the process. And they said, have a smell of that. Well, I lifted it up, and I had a smell. Well, as you know, I'm not very tall. I'm only 4'5". So whereas somebody of 5 or 6 foot would smell it vaguely and think, oh, that's very nice, it all went up my nose. It was like, oh, my gosh, that is quite something. And I quickly shut it up and recovered my bearing. But it can be overwhelming. But I think that I'm right in saying that the sense of memory, the sense of you're saying you could drink a quite humble wine, but with friends, you would love it. And I think a lot of smells, a lot of tastes are about the people we're with and about the memories they evoke. And, you know, as you know, in Proust, at the beginning, he has a cup of lime flower tea and he remembers his entire childhood in Combray. And, that Proustian moment is a cliche, but it works because the taste is what takes them back.
Yeah, well, let's put that taste into the time capsule for you.
Thank you.
I think I've worked out what my sign name would be.
What would it be?
Well, it's that thing that they always do on Strictly Come Dancing, where they wave their hands at the side, which is a sign for applause. So I think,
yes,
as an actor, I think I'd have to
go
for that.
Yes, that would be fantastic. And, and you know, we just clap and make this horrible noise. But if you're deaf, as you say, you wave your hands, it's a lovely reaction.
Isn't it just? It's a lovely thing to see when you do shows and you have an audience there of people who are audio impaired, and then they all wave their hands at the end. It's better than actually people bringing their hands together.
It is a wonderful reaction. Mm. And I want to say it for the sign language interpreters, because to interpret well and to get that expression, because you as an actor, you will carry a lot of meaning in how you say things. And all they have is the visuals, and they will display that in their interpretation of what you say, just brilliantly.
It is brilliant. It's brilliant to watch. I once in a pantomime had a very, very complicated sort of tongue twister to say as part of the script. And at the end of it, I stopped and I turned to the signer and said, go on, do that. And then she did. It was absolutely amazing.
That is a beautiful thing. It is amazing how, I mean, I think language is fantastic. We've talked about P.G. Woodhouse and Terry Pratchett and all the rest of it, and being able to do beautiful, measured, balanced things with language. Well, all of that is also possible with the visuals of sign language, which is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, fantastic. Tom, it's been really lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for giving me your time.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Well, I hope your back gets better soon.
I will be up in no time. Yeah, signing books.
Well, I should come along and get one signed.
Thank you. I look forward to that. Thanks, Michael.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Tom Shakespeare.
My thanks to Tom, but also my apologies. I was so enjoying our conversation that I forgot to ask him the one thing from his life he'd like to bury and forget. Instead, we got five lovely things. So that makes it a very special and rather delightful time capsule. Tom did get back in touch with me and said, "Do you want to record a bit more?" But I said, "No, I'm very happy with it. And if I'm happy, then you're happy and we're all happy, surely." I wonder if we'll ever get a time capsule where someone says they can't think of anything nice they want, and we end up with lots of things that can all be buried and banished to a hole in the ground forever. I doubt it. Anyway, if you enjoyed listening to my time capsule, then do subscribe, rate, or review it, and do tell your friends. We're heading towards the 400 episode mark. Faster than I imagined possible, of course. So there are lots of episodes to choose from if you're new to this podcast. You can get in touch with me or my producer on social media. I'm there as me, and he's there as my TC Pod. So search us out and let us know what you think. Not too many swear words, please. I'm sure we'll get the point. The theme tune by Pass the Peas Music is available on Spotify. We have a sort of Patreon thing called Acast Plus, where you pay a small monthly fee and get this podcast ad-free, plus a bonus podcast every week, which we're very grateful for if you think giving us your support is worthwhile. The details are in the description of this pod, and you'll also find a link to Tom's novel, The Ha Ha. So do check it out. This was a cast-off production for Acast, and it was produced by John Fenton Stevens. Okay, stay well and happy. I'm quite happy at the moment. Well, I'm usually happy, but I'm particularly happy at the moment because I've been sorting out the garden. I dug a big hole so I could make a pond because, as my dear departed friend Jeremy Pascal always said, if you look after the peonies, the ponds will look after themselves. Problem was, I didn't know what to do with the big pile of earth that was left by the side of the pond once I'd dug the hole. Still, don't worry, I sorted it. I dug another hole and put it all in there. Clever, eh? Yeah, bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.